What's up, fools? This is the QTR Podcast. Today is July 28th, 2018, and I have a really awesome guest today, so much so that we both got up early this morning to make sure that we would have enough time to shoot the shit. So we're doing an early morning podcast this morning. I don't know when you guys are listening. It doesn't really matter, but we dragged our asses out of bed on a Saturday. Just because I thought that this would be a cool interview and I didn't want to have any type of time constraints. Before we get started, I just want to let you know that today's podcast is brought to you by my Patreons. If you don't know what Patreon is, it is a site that allows you to donate a very small, or very large if you would like, monthly recurring fee just to support the creators and the podcast. I guess it's you can use it to support anybody, but I think it's for creators of all types, people that do podcasts, people that run their own websites. It's completely donation based. As I've always said on my Twitter, the podcast is always going to be free, but I do have people going in signing up for my Patreon, which I really, really appreciate. And actually, I'm not even ready for this because I wanted to read off some of the names of my newest Patreon. So I have the list right here, and I just want to give a shout to Lindsay, Mike, Ethan, Jerry, CJ, Michael, Pat, MCR, Michael, Richie, Michael K, Robert, Brendan, Robert, and Bruce. Those are my latest Patreons that are making it happen, and I really appreciate you guys. It's and especially Michael Samuels, who went out of his way to make a decent donation, so I really appreciate that a lot, and that helps keep the QTR podcast free and helps me keep it ad-free and less annoying, because nobody likes advertisements when you're an hour deep into a conversation. Anyways, enough of that. I have a pretty interesting guest with me today who, when he told me who he was, I had to agree to bring him on. Some people have been kind of petitioning me since I've started the podcast to have me on. They're like, oh, have me on. I'm interesting. This guy is interesting. Oh, why don't you look at this guy? It's always people that I'm not interested in. And the theme to my podcast, I guess from the beginning, has always been just to kind of bring on the things that interest me, and hopefully it interests you guys as well. But today we have a gentleman by the name of Aaron Greenspan, and he sent me some shit last night and was telling me to kind of read up on him. And I said, you know what? We're just going to learn about you together on the podcast, because I want the listeners who also don't know anything about you to kind of start from square one. But Aaron pitched himself as a guest to me. And actually, Christine Richard pitched you as a guest also, too, by telling me that he had created the original Facebook at Harvard University and that he was a classmate of Mark Zuckerberg's, who then subsequently, according to him, I think copied his idea and came up with the Facebook that we know today. And since Facebook has been in the news prominently and is becoming somewhat of a controversial topic, I thought it would be a really cool idea to have him on and get his thoughts on things and hear what I'm guessing is going to be a very interesting story. So Aaron Greenspan, he's an entrepreneur and engineer. He has a background in enterprise software. He's the president and CEO of Think Computer Corporation, and he is the founder of Think Computer Foundation, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. He's worked on engineering problems involving accounting, payments, legal systems. Though he is not a lawyer, he has represented himself and his company before several state and federal courts, as well as the United States Patent and Trademark Office, Trademark Trial, and Appeal Board. Aaron, of course, has an AB in economics from Harvard College, must be a community college, never heard of it, and is the author of a memoir about his time there, during which he developed the predecessor to Facebook. With all that shit being said, oh, and he runs, do you run Plainsight, or is that your whole deal, or are you a contributor there? What's the technical status there?
Yeah, I run Plainsight.
Okay, so he also runs Plainsight, which is a legal website that makes large volumes of data, legal data accessible to the public free of charge. And it says here, Plainsight lets ordinary citizens impact the lawmaking process. So shit, we have a lot of stuff we could talk about, because as far as I know also too, you contributed to that massive Herbalife document that went out a couple of months ago that linked the company to money laundering and a bunch of other things. So we have a lot of stuff to talk about. So first off, what's going on? How are you at 7:30 in the morning on a Saturday?
Doing well. I'm sitting here in my pajamas, you know, enjoying the morning.
Beautiful. Excellent. So let's talk about Facebook and let's talk about Harvard College. Why don't you tell everybody, including me, who has no clue about your involvement in the early days of Facebook, what your involvement in the early days of Facebook was?
Sure. Well, so I guess I'll start the way that most people think about this issue, which is based on the movie. So not everyone has seen The Social Network, but generally speaking, it's become the de facto history of Facebook's early days, for better or for worse. And I'd argue that, unfortunately, it's mostly for worse, even though it was a pretty decent movie. Most people who meet me and haven't heard my name ask, well, who were you in the movie? Because, you know, I don't remember there being someone named Aaron. And the answer is I was nobody in the movie. I wasn't actually in it. But there's more to the story than that. The Social Network was based on a book by an author named Ben Mezrich, who is himself a matter of some controversy. Before The Social Network came out, he did a book on the MIT blackjack team, which turned into the movie 21.
Right, I remember that.
And that actually, it's relevant to this whole story because 21 was produced by Sony Pictures and so was The Social Network. So this isn't totally chronological, but hopefully people will bear with me. When I graduated from college and this was all kind of fresh in my mind, I thought, you know, I think what happened will end up being pretty important. So I'm going to write a book. I didn't write a thesis because I got sick of school and decided to graduate a year early. So I felt a little bit bad. A lot of my friends were spending all their time writing. And I was like, you know, I'm not writing anything.
So most people that get sick of school drop out. They don't graduate a year early.
Well, I was ready to drop out. I was very upset at the time. And I told my parents, actually, almost as soon as I got there, that I wanted to drop out. But I stuck with it, which, you know, in retrospect, might have been a horrible mistake and could have cost billions of dollars. But, you know, that's how things go. So I decided to write this book, and I pitched it to publishers in New York, and I had an agent and all that, although, you know, that took a while because people weren't initially really sure what to make of it. It didn't sound believable, I think, to a lot of people. And so the publishers all turned it down, and in particular, Random House, before it was acquired by Penguin, turned it down through its Doubleday imprint. And then not too long after that, about, I think, you know, maybe 6 months to a year, there was an article on Gawker, back when there was a Gawker, and it turned out that Ben Mezrich had pitched a book about the creation of Facebook to Doubleday, and Doubleday, which had just met me, said, you know what, that's a great idea. We'll pay you $2 million. So Ben got his $2 million advance. And essentially, the whole project was designed before the book was even written to be sold to Sony Pictures once again, just like 21. Because, you know, when you have this prior relationship, it's an easier deal for people to digest. So, you know, then he had a contract to write a book, and he is himself a Harvard graduate, although I find that kind of hard to believe at times. But he decided to start getting sources for his book because he had no idea what to write. He wasn't there at the time. He didn't really know anything about it. So he contacted me, and then he contacted Eduardo Severin. And I turned him down because I was afraid that he would totally distort my character the way that he'd done that to some of the characters in the MIT story. And Eduardo ended up cooperating with him for a time until his lawyers told him he had to stop. So the end product was this really weird compendium of like false information and anecdotes from Eduardo that I don't think are really verifiable or true, most of them. And so then that book got turned into the movie through this crazy process where he was late producing the draft, and then Aaron Sorkin started writing. So, like, you know, Social Network is a good movie, but there are some holes, and I am one of the holes.
Got you. And it's funny because last night I was at a bar and I was talking to somebody about how I had to get up this morning to do an interview. And they were like, oh, who are you interviewing? I said, I don't know, one of the original Facebook guys. And they were like, of course, who was he in the movie? I said, I don't fucking know. I have no idea. I'll ask him tomorrow. We'll find out tomorrow. But you're right. That's the first thing people ask him. Little known. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, little known fact, too, as well, that Jesse Eisenberg, who played Mark Zuckerberg in that movie, is actually one of my childhood friends.
That's hilarious.
So,
well, yeah, he's a good actor, but his Mark Zuckerberg is, as I recall, considerably different from the one I remember.
Is it? All right, cool. I want to hear about that. Tell me kind of the story. I mean, how do you fit into the whole mesh of things?
So, yeah, the story, I think, is actually more interesting now than it ever has been, in a way. Not necessarily because of my involvement, but because of what really happened that I think most people just have no idea about. I got to Harvard in 2001 in the fall, and in the kind of macroeconomic history landscape, that was right after or right as the dot-com bubble was collapsing.
Right.
And what that meant was that the computer science program at Harvard and at many colleges, I'm sure, was really suffering. You know, it had huge enrollment in 1998, 2000. And then all of a sudden, no one wanted to go into CS anymore because this wasn't the future everyone had been promised. And so, you know, there wasn't a lot going on campus technology-wise, but that's actually a large part of why I had gone to Harvard in particular, was that they had promised that, you know, there was this entrepreneurship program they had, and it had this big endowment, and it turned out to be largely lies. But I just wanted to, you know, work with computers and study something interesting and check my email. And it turned out checking my email, surprisingly difficult at Harvard in 2001. There was no web-based email system. And the administration was really kind of stodgy and slow, big surprise for, you know, 300-year-old institution. So I decided to make my own webmail system freshman year that people could use, and so that was fine, and I let the administration know and nobody cared, and I just kept doing it. And then later on, I was kind of dissatisfied with my courses that I was taking, because the teachers, some of them were not the best, to say the least. So I made this system as a statistics class project where you could weave feedback about your classes online. And then there was a problem where you always had to pay all this money for textbooks, and there were all these people on campus who already had the textbook, so it seemed silly to be wasting all that money. So I made this textbook exchange system, because the one that was officially on campus didn't work very well. And eventually I had all these little projects I'd built, and I decided to combine them all because, you know, there were getting to be too many. And I put them into a student portal that I called House System. And that was because when you're a student, you live in one of the residential houses as an upperclassman. So there's Harvard Yard is where the freshmen live, and the different houses around Harvard Yard, some of them are by the Charles River, some of them are up in what's called the Quad. That's the whole residential house system. It's based on the British system, like from Oxford and Cambridge. And so we had this thing, House System, I built in the summer, like August of 2003. And I was really excited about it because it seemed like there was, you know, nothing quite like it. And I had a lot of big plans, and I ran an entrepreneurship club eventually that I thought could use it as kind of like a model software company, so students could see what it was like to actually like build software and have to produce a product that people actually used, and it wasn't, you know, purely theoretical like a lot of the curriculum. So that was all well and good, and I launched it in late August, and then in September I decided to add this Facebook feature where it would have more functionality than the traditional Harvard Facebooks, which were, believe it or not, black and white, many of them, even online.
Did you actually call it Facebook?
Yeah, so it was actually called the Facebook, but that wasn't that surprising, really, because we had a Facebook, and it was the Harvard official Facebook, first of all, for the freshman class when you got there. Although I think they called it the freshman register, but everyone actually called it the Facebook.
Okay, Harvard had their own Facebook for people like, hey, get to know your classmates kind of thing, whatever. And then you split off from that, and in creating this whole new system with the webmail and the textbook exchange, did your own Facebook as well.
Right. Because there was a specific problem, and you know, this was the theme with all of these different projects I was working on, is I kept finding things on campus that I found for one reason or another to be, you know, unsatisfactory, and thought I could make a better version or something. So the Facebook that we got as freshmen was paper. There was no electronic copy. When you got to a house in your sophomore year, that house is really supposed to be your community, according to the university. Of course, it doesn't really work that way, but that's what they would like to think, or back, you know, in 2002. I was in Wool House, which is one of the river houses. So Wool House had its own Facebook, which again was, I can't emphasize how basic everything was. It was black and white.
Right.
It had your Harvard 5-digit phone number. Everyone had these like red phones that you could call on campus. It had your email address, had your name, of course, and your concentration, which is Harvard's word for your major. But it didn't really have anything else. And of course, you know, generally people at Harvard are interesting people, and you might want to know more about them and like what they're planning to do with their life, maybe, or what they think is an interesting quote, or, you know.
And people, right? And people need to realize too that in 2001, I mean, the internet itself was, it was prominent. It had definitely turned, I think by 2000, because that's when I graduated high school, it had definitely turned the page to being, you know, starting to integrate itself into everyday life. But it was nothing like it was today, which is why, you know, if you're stunned to hear that they didn't have a webmail system, you know, everything was very basic. It was very archaic back then. The web was in color, and I think we were probably using Netscape Navigator or Internet Explorer at the time or whatever, but it wasn't anything close to what it is today.
No, it really wasn't. Google did not exist as a real, you know, industry force back then. It was really Microsoft that was the key player.
GeoCities and...
The biggest difference is that there were no cell phones with screens.
Right.
Know, everyone had, you know, flip phones if they had cell phones at all. And, you know, there was no Wi-Fi. So if you wanted to be on the internet, you had to be physically connected with an Ethernet cable.
Yeah. But, I remember when going into college, there were like 6 dorms, I think, on my campus, and only 2 or 3 of them had been wired for Cat5, right? To have a wired Ethernet connection. So the Wi-Fi wasn't even a thing. And I just remember getting my acceptance letter and seeing that I was going to be in Sanderson Hall, which has since been knocked down. But that was at the forefront of where they were in terms of technology back then, because they actually had a place where you could plug in your Ethernet cable. But, you know, people were still on dial-up in 2001. And I mean, can you imagine going to university and being put into a dorm where you don't have internet access? I mean, forget about Wi-Fi, but you don't even have a...
Yeah, that that would have been a tragedy, I think, in that day and age, for me anyway. I was fortunate in that, you know, we did have internet at all the different dorms at Harvard. But this is where it actually starts to matter, is because since there was no Wi-Fi and since there was, you know, a lot of really big, like I had a 17-inch or something monitor that weighed, you know, 60 pounds.
Yeah, like an old really CRT, tethered, right?
Yeah, you were tethered to your computer, and they had rules in place for some of the houses. Like, for example, Winthrop House, which was, you know, what, 400 feet from Lowell House? If you wanted to access the Winthrop House Facebook, you had to be on a computer in Winthrop House.
Right.
And, you know, your key card may or may not let you in, right? So they had actually segmented the student population according to these arbitrary borders that none of us wanted. You know, if you met someone in class and you wanted to know how to call them, it made no sense that you shouldn't be able to look up their phone number because they lived in a different house.
Right.
And, you know, Dunster House, I don't think you had to physically be in the house, but you did have to have a Dunster username and password, and you couldn't use their Facebook without it. So, like, this is maddening, right? If you're in college and you're trying to, like, make friends and talk to people, which is the whole point to some extent, you know, having the administration tell you, nope, you can't do that. Sorry, we have rules here. And it's like totally arbitrary, very frustrating. So my response to that was to say, essentially, screw your rules. I'm going to build my own. And I built what I called formally the Universal Facebook, because the idea was that it didn't have to obey the administration's silly rules. But, you know, in other emails and when people referred to it, it was called the Facebook. So, you know, it may seem strange, but the reaction at the time was essentially mostly that nobody cared and that this is something that would be, you know, asking a lot of people to upload a single photograph of themselves that was like, you know, 100 pixels high and expect them to type in a favorite quote and their cell phone number. You know, that was pushing the envelope,
right?
Not in terms of technology. And I think this is a really crucial point. The success of Mark's Facebook was not so much a technological leap, I think, because the tech stack he used for his Facebook was the same as I used for mine, but it was a cultural change.
Right.
You know, there was, and this gets into the story that I think most people don't realize. And this is largely why I wrote that memoir back in the day, is because I thought this really needed to be written down. Each house had its own mailing list called an open list. So, you know, there was like Mather Open, and there was Wool Open that I was on, and there was Kirkland Open that Mark was on. And you could join other houses' mailing lists if you wanted to, but generally speaking, you would join the list for your own house. And so when my student portal house system launched, I of course wanted all of the different house open lists to know about it so that people would join. And ultimately about 1500 people or 1600 people did. But there were some people on the mailing list who I had never met who were, I think, gravely concerned that what I was doing was somehow wrong and dangerous. And in particular, what worried people and eventually the Harvard administration was that I had built this web-based email system, which, as I said, you know, since my freshman year, nobody had cared about. And I had built that into house system such that in order to use house system, because I wanted it to be able to tell you if you had new email, I said, use your Harvard password, which, you know, in retrospect, this is a terrible mistake. But people got very suspicious because I was saying, use your Harvard password. We'll use it to fetch your email from the IMAP server, and then you'll have an idea of what's going on without having to sign into a Unix terminal somewhere. And so they said, you know, oh, Aaron Greenspan is stealing student passwords and is doing all these horrible things, and you can't trust him, and who knows who he is and what he's doing. You know, I had written the software to immediately clear the password from memory, to automatically pass it to the mail server without my doing anything with it. It wasn't stored in the database in plain text. Like, there was no issue here. No one had stolen passwords. No one had their account compromised. Like, this was done in the most responsible manner possible. And I offered to show the source code to Harvard's administrators once they got concerned, and they said, no, we don't want to see it. So it was kind of a crazy non-issue, but then the Crimson started writing about it, and it got bigger and bigger. And at one point, I was on vacation with my family, and I was getting emails from Harvard administrators, and they were essentially, I mean, they didn't quite say this point blank, but they said they wanted to have some meetings. And the overtone was, we're going to kick you out of school. Like, we think you're stealing student information, and that's unacceptable, and you're going to be ad boarded.
Just for having made this thing that people are voluntarily submitting their information to.
Right. It was totally opt-in, right? It wasn't as though I was going through and stealing information from Harvard.
Sure, sure.
Facebook's like someone else that people know about today. So I ended up hiring pro bono, fortunately, a few lawyers in Boston who managed to guide me through these communications with the administration. And eventually they backed off once they realized I had lawyers. And it's funny because I don't think I ever actually told them I had lawyers, but, you know, they are Harvard administrators, and I was a student, and they had the right to read my email. So I think they were reading my email, and based on my attorney-client privilege communications that they could read, they decided, all right, maybe this isn't worth the fight that we thought it was. So upshot of all this is that by, I'd say October, November of 2003, there was this Facebook on house system. Like, 100 people had signed up, not that many in the grand scheme of things. And one of them was Mark Zuckerberg, but, you know, he's one of 100 people on there, so who cares? And then, you know, unbeknownst to me.
So at this point, you're saying there's several Facebooks at this point?
Well, there's Harvard's Facebooks, and there's mine, and that's really it.
Okay, and Zuckerberg had signed up to yours?
Zuckerberg has signed up to mine.
Okay.
And I don't know who he is until the Crimson writes about him for a totally unrelated reason, which is that he had built some sort of music player, I guess, like an MP3 player in high school.
Okay.
And they profiled him because of that. And they're like, you know, look at this guy who knows how to use computers, essentially. And I was running the Entrepreneurship Club then, so I thought, oh, well, you know, I should definitely get in touch with, you know, one of the 4 people on campus who seems to have an interest in business and computers. So I sent him an email, and you know, he's busy and I was busy, so I guess it took a while for us to actually meet. But by January 2004, we had agreed to meet for dinner, and I met him for dinner on January 8th. And it's easy to remember these dates for me because January 11th was the day that he bought the Facebook.com as a domain name. And I always know I met him for dinner 3 days before that. So at dinner,
he had previously shown no interest in creating a Facebook as far as you're concerned.
Well, so I think during late 2003, that is when he was having his own dispute with ConnectU and the Winklevoss twins and Divya Narendra. And I didn't know any of them. They were in the Quad, not the River Houses, so they were physically far away. They were also, like, you know, these big rower guys, and I was this average computer nerd. So we didn't really have a lot of opportunities to cross paths. Or maybe we did, and I just had no idea who they were. But yeah, they were dealing with Mark on a separate front that I was unaware of. And so by the time Mark and I met for dinner, I didn't know any of that. He knew that I was running this thing that involved a Facebook that he had signed up for and that he had actually used going back and looking at log files to search for the Winklevosses because he was afraid that I might be working with them. But I didn't know who the Winklevosses were, so that, you know, didn't really mean anything to me. So at dinner, he offered to to enlist my help essentially for this project he was working on, and he wouldn't tell me what it was, which I found kind of annoying. Like, you want my help, fine, but what am I helping you with? And he also struck me as just, well, I think unprofessional is putting it mildly, because, you know, he'd also been written up in the Crimson, not just for his MP3 player, but also for FaceMash, which, I mean, now we're in the middle of the Me Too movement, and it's, I think, kind of remarkable that...
For what?
This is a guy... The Me Too movement.
Yeah, I know, but you said you said he was written up for his MP3 player, but he was also written up for...
For FaceMash.
I don't know what that is.
FaceMash was this website he made where the initial idea he had was to compare pictures of, I think, female students to farm animals. And people could choose which was better. But then at the last minute, he decided farm animals was too controversial. And he switched it to just comparing students to each other.
Okay.
Which is still, you know, maybe that's what people are doing with the paper Facebook anyway.
Yeah, but... well, don't you remember in like, I remember in like 2002, and I mean, I remember being in college and there was a website called hotornot.com. Do you remember that?
Yeah, exactly.
And that was like essentially the same thing.
For Harvard students.
Okay. And, okay.
You know, you can build that if you want to, but I feel like you should expect some blowback.
Sure,
from that. It's really, it's not a nice thing to do.
Okay, and so he got he got written up for FaceMash.
Yeah, and he got sent to the ad board for real. He did not manage to avoid it the way that I did. And that is part of why we wanted to have dinners, because he knew that I had had this whole administration experience that I had managed to come out of unscathed. And he was very interested at the time in, you know, not getting kicked out of school, I guess. So he thought maybe I'd have some tips I could share. But this quickly turned into him asking if I'd help him with this new thing. And I'm thinking, well, you just violated a lot of people's rights, so I'm not sure I want to really work with you right away. And also he had no facial expressions, which was very strange. But, and then at the same time I was thinking, well, I could use some help running House System, because it's really just me doing all the programming right now. And, you know, it would be nice to have someone I can rely on so that I can actually like do my coursework once in a while. But in the end, we're both, I think, kind of wary of each other, and neither of us really agreed to help the other, but we did exchange AIM screen names. So at the time people didn't use Facebook Messenger or Google Chat, which didn't exist yet. It was AOL.
Yeah. So, AIM and AOL. Right.
So, you know, we talked on AIM fairly often, and we ended up being the next semester, which is only a few weeks after this, in a computer science independent study together. So we had reason to talk about that, because we were building this voice recognition engine in PHP, which is the same language Facebook was written in, both mine and his. But, you know, like I said, I kind of didn't trust him after that dinner, and I started getting in the habit of saving all of our conversations, which is not something I did with most of my friends. You know, if something was particularly funny or something, I'd save it, but you know, I wasn't in the habit of keeping tabs on people. Like, I thought, you know, this guy might say something I really want to go back and reference later. So I saved a lot of these conversations, and you know, the rest is kind of history. On February 4th, he launched his Facebook without telling me. And
what was the date?
It was February 4th, 04.
Okay. Oh, so that was only a month after he had dinner.
Yeah. He bought the domain name on January 11th and launched it about a month after that. And, you know, and we'd been talking on AIM this whole time, so I was a little bit surprised that he would know about, sign up for, use extensively, pick my brain about my Facebook, you know, talking about server settings and stuff like that.
Right.
Build his own give it the same name, launch it in the same place, not tell me about it, and then still show up to class and think that we're friends. And I thought, wow, that's kind of messed up. I don't think that's something that one of my other friends would do, certainly.
Was there anybody else trying to kind of become a derivative of the Harvard Facebook, or was it just, to the best of your knowledge, the two of you? Was anybody else trying to do the same thing? I mean, the way that, so what I'm learning here for the first time is that Harvard had its own Facebook, which I didn't know, and that the name, the Facebook, was ubiquitous, that it wasn't just something that he created. Was, to the best of your knowledge, were there any other people working on similar projects, or was it just the two of you?
Well, to my knowledge, no one else was, and I should have known, because I was running that club and I was trying to keep tabs on pretty much every entrepreneurial, you know, endeavor on campus, more or less. And I had a lot of people emailing me with their ideas and aspirations and trying to get advice. So I don't know of anyone else who was doing it. I do know that the Crimson wrote an article sometime, I think in late 2003, saying that, you know, we really should have a better Facebook. And I've heard Mark say that what he built was in response to that Crimson article, which I don't know if I completely believe, but you know, there might be some truth to it. But what I do know is this, what you said is interesting, that you didn't know that Harvard had its own Facebook. You know, some people are aware that there are different, you know, not just Harvard, but also many of the Ivy League schools had Facebooks going back to the 50s, if not earlier. But when Mark moved out to Palo Alto in, I think, 2005, he quickly was able to raise VC from Peter Thiel and then Accel Partners. And he was interviewed at Stanford, I think also in 2005, and one of the Accel guys, Jim Breyer, was on stage with him. And Jim asks him in this video, which you can find on YouTube, so tell me how the Facebook got started. And Mark, in this really kind of smug tone, says, well, you know, Harvard didn't have a Facebook. I decided to make one, and that's how it got started. And like, that's just a lie so many ways around. It's really hard to fathom how he thought that would be a good idea to say on video. You know, Harvard did have a Facebook. He was clearly aware of mine. So, you know, I guess he just wanted to seem impressive or something. But, you know, that came back to bite him when we ended up in settlement negotiations, because I was able to play that video and, you know, his lawyers had to watch it and figure out, okay, now what do we do about this? So.
So you sued him, yeah, ultimately?
So technically it wasn't a lawsuit. What happened was, you know, we went our separate ways, although we kept talking on AIM for quite a while until something else very interesting in retrospect happened, which is, so now everyone is well aware of the Cambridge Analytica debate, or not even debate, debacle, I think is a better word. And you can make an argument, certainly, that that was one of the ingredients in this $120 billion, you know, falling off a cliff that just happened to their stock. Before Cambridge Analytica happened in 2016, in 2005, when I was then living off campus because I had graduated, and he was, I think, must have been in Palo Alto at that point, there was a bug on the site. And I was thinking at the time that maybe I would go into like computer security. I wasn't really sure what I was going to do. I wanted to work for myself.
Had you abandoned your project by then in 2005?
When this happened, I don't think I had yet abandoned it, but I did soon after that.
And he,
I decided that.
So he had the Facebook.com. And had you even started to kind of make yours accessible? Talk to me about where you both were in terms of making it accessible to people off campus and trying to get it out there out of Harvard, where you guys were kind of both at with that.
My thinking was that I would sell it to other campuses,
right?
And you know, his was that it would be free and then anyone could sign up and he would just keep growing it. And so I mean, I feel like I'm skipping around and forgetting things, and there's just so much to say about all of this. So forgive me for that. But Mark and I had, first of all, very similar feature sets, because there had been specific feature sets that I had built on House System that he brought over to his Facebook somehow or another that seemed very similar. So, for example, one of my friends in my club, Tom Tantratuvud, who's Thai, he came up with this idea that in Thailand, birthdays are very important to people, so we should have a birthday reminder service. So we built that. And then as soon as we built that, that showed up on Mark's Facebook. And of course, that's a very big part of Facebook, the birthday thing. And then I was really interested in optimizing the way that people advertise events on campus, because, you know, in Cambridge in the winter, when you have to go put up a poster on all these poster boards at 6:30 in the morning, which is what the campus required, you know, it's miserable. You don't want to get out and trudge around in the snow for that long. So I made an electronic poster board where you could RSVP to events electronically, and it would show you the attendee list, and, you know, that became a thing on Facebook. But even though we had these similar feature sets, we had very, very different philosophies about how this should be approached from a growth standpoint, I suppose. My concern was always having, I guess you could call it, a high quality network, which is kind of an obnoxious phrase, I guess. But I wanted to make sure that the content on the site was good and reliable, and you know, you could trust that you were seeing, right? Whereas Mark was far more interested, I would say exclusively interested, in growth. He wanted to get as many people on as fast as possible at any cost. And we discussed this, and I told him, look, you know, you do have a lot of people on your site now, but what would be really interesting is if you were to able to turn this into essentially the world's largest spam-free email system. Because you've, you know, got all these verified people from their email addresses on your network, they can communicate with your messaging tool. Like, there's no spam. That's remarkable. You know, that normal SMTP email has spam as like a built-in problem. And he was totally disinterested in that, not because it's not an interesting idea, I think, but because it would restrict growth. And he said that, you know, I don't like putting barriers in the way to growth. So for the next, 13 years, that seemed like the right choice, right? You know, Facebook got bigger and bigger and bigger, and its market cap increased and increased and increased, and there was seemingly nothing that could stop it until this week, when the market really seemed to think, we have a problem here. And the problem is that, well, A, growth won't continue forever, obviously, but also, when you grow at any expense, crazy things can happen, like the KGB can take over your system. And like that, frankly, it never occurred to me or him, I'm sure. But what had occurred to me at that dinner in 04 was that, you know, I had some experience doing entrepreneurship type stuff in high school, and this kid who was at a contest I was at started an All Advantage clone. I don't know if you remember All Advantage, but they would pay you to watch banner ads. It was a horrible.
No, but I remember a lot of similar sites like that, though.
Yeah, so I designed the HTML for his site, and then he started relying on me for advice and stuff, and eventually the FBI got involved because it was effectively a pyramid scheme, although in high school I didn't really know what that was, although I eventually quit once I figured out what was going on. But, you know, the FBI showed up at my house and interviewed me about these death threats this kid was getting. And I thought, you know, as I was talking to Mark, I'm pretty sure the FBI is going to end up at somebody's house because of this idea he has, you know, which again, he wouldn't fully tell me. The most he would tell me was that it was a project involving graph theory. And I asked him, is that a Friendster for Harvard? And he said, well, I can't tell you. But point of all this is, it's interesting now because for many years I thought, well, you know, I guess I missed the boat in terms of building this infinitely large Facebook. But at the same time, I'm now kind of proud of what I didn't build because, you know, sure, I'm not a billionaire, but I don't think you need to be a billionaire to be happy in life, number one. And number two, what he built was really incredibly harmful and detrimental to society just in the Cambridge Analytica, you know, Russian hacking sphere, let alone all the other many, many, many problems that are associated with Facebook today. So again, I'm skipping around, but I think maybe your listeners will get some of the context, at least.
Did you sue him?
How things went out. Right. So after this all transpired, I decided to write my book, right? And so I wrote it, and I tried to get it published, and nobody would publish it because few people thought Facebook mattered in New York publishing circles in 2007. And those that did, they didn't seem to want to write anything negative about it. You know, they had a fairly good PR effort, I got to say, in Palo Alto. So I published it myself. I hired a book printer, and I have some graphic design ability, so I tried to make it look as much like a real book as I could. And I put this thing out there, and you can find it on Amazon now. You can buy it if you want to. It's terribly out of date since it was published in 2008, and you'll find such reviews as like, this book never should have been written, because, you know, for the majority of the time that it's been published, people have thought of Zuckerberg as a god. So the reviews more or less reflect that, and I'm just the jealous leech who didn't you know, get his billions or something in most people's minds. But published the book, wanted to advertise it, and I thought, well, you know, Google has this AdWords thing I can use, so I'll try AdWords. And when I went to Google, they wouldn't let me advertise it because they said it's called Authoritas, and the subtitle is One Student's Harvard Admissions and the Founding of the Facebook Era. So they said, because the word Facebook appears in your subtitle, we will not let you post this ad. Facebook is a registered trademark of Facebook Incorporated, and you would be violating their trademark rights were we to let you advertise. So at that point, I was like, you got to be kidding me. Because, like, fine, I don't get credit for building the thing I built. That's one thing. But then I can't even tell the story about it. That's insane. So I decided to petition to cancel their Facebook trademark. I think I did two separate petitions. I can't remember exactly why. It's been a while. But
this is 2008?
Yeah, this is 2008. And you
legally petitioned, or you actually just...
Yeah, no, this is a formal petition before the USPTO Trademark Final Appeal Board.
Got you.
I had dealt with this board. It's part of the Patent and Trademark Office. In high school, running my company, which did like IT consulting and software development, I had called my company in 1998, Think Computer Corporation, and then there was a company in Irvine, California that changed its name from HCO Computer Products to Think Computer Products. So we had like an 8-year trademark battle, and I had become sort of versed in trademark law as a result of that. I ended up winning that battle, you know, so that was a huge victory in the grand scheme of things, right, compared to Facebook. But, so I filed these petitions, and I did it myself because I tried to find a lawyer who would represent me, and I'd be like, hey there, I have this dispute with Facebook, and I have proof that I invented it, and most people would be like, yeah, right. And I think the one lawyer I found who was willing to maybe consider it said that the firm wanted $15,000 as a retainer just to consider the case. And I didn't have $15,000 to pay anyone. So that wasn't really going to work. But yeah, I filed those petitions. They kind of proceeded for a while. The USPTO eventually ruled that the grounds I had filed them on, which were priority of use, like I had it first.
Right.
Genericness is that it was a generic term anyway. And fraud on the USPTO, which is that when Sean Parker and Mark, I think it was actually Sean who signed it, but you know, when you file for a trademark, you have to tell the patent and trademark office you believe under penalty of perjury that no one else has the rights to this name, and that, you know, this is something that you came up with, and in the international class that you're using it, there's no one else you know of who has the right to it.
Right.
So when they said that, they were lying, and that is fraud. So eventually those petitions were allowed to proceed, and then I got a call in like April of 2009 from Facebook's lawyers saying, we like to talk about settling. And I, at that point, was able to find a law firm shortly before that, I think. And then they handled the settlement, and it went to mediation, actually the same mediator who did the Winklevoss's mediation, ironically. I didn't know that at the time.
What kind of settlement is that? Is it a monetary settlement? Is it a, you just, you know, are they basically just going to pay you to back the fuck up, like, and just leave it alone? Or is it, what?
So it's a confidential settlement. So officially, I am not allowed to say whether or not it involved money. However, what I will tell you is that there are public domain materials, such as Think Computer Foundation's 2009 Form 990, that suggests that, not even suggest, that indicate that in 2009, Think Computer Foundation received a significant donation. So, you know, I will abide by the terms of my contract because I'm not like Mark. And I think the rule of law is important, but technically I can't tell you.
I want you to talk about the whole Cambridge Analytica thing. Tell people what it is. And, you know, I feel like you have this perspective where you probably understand how this stuff works a lot better than the average layperson. And even to somebody like me, I mean, I see headlines over the last year or two about privacy, about, you know, data being sold. Tell the listeners what exactly went on and how it works from somebody that knows the ins and the outs of the software side of things, and probably just generally knows the ins and outs of the story better than anybody else.
Well, I mean, I can tell you I have a good general understanding, but I should make it really clear. I wasn't there for anything, right? I've never worked for the company. I've never been a direct shareholder of the company. So I'm in some respects just another guy on the street, but I do have a general sense of what happened. So going back to Mark's number one obsession with growth, back in 2007, the company introduced, I think it was 07, they introduced this Facebook platform for developers. And the idea was that, you know, you want to build a product that other people depend upon because that gives you leverage, right? It gives you power. It lets you expand. This is, you can look at Microsoft Windows the same way, or Mac OS, you know, for many, many years, Gates and Jobs were extremely concerned about getting developers to build for their respective platforms because that meant that they would win the operating system wars in the end. And people had very lofty ideas that Facebook would be the next operating system, it would be the operating system for the internet, all this kind of stuff that sounds like nonsense now. But it wasn't crazy, right? It was a reasonable approach. However, the way they went about implementing their Facebook platform was what you would expect from someone like Mark, who lies all the time and has no respect for other people. And if you're a shareholder, by the way, keep that in mind.
Those are pretty big charges. I mean, I guess Mark would say, or somebody that's on the other side of the equation would say, like, here's a guy that feels like he got left out, and now he's just kind of shit-talking this guy.
Yeah, but thank God. I mean, I am so glad to have been left out of this story now. I mean, for a time, that wasn't true. I was upset. But when I settled with them, as I said, I've never been a shareholder of Facebook. So just think about that in terms of the settlement context. There might have been an opportunity to be a shareholder of Facebook.
Right.
And I've never been a shareholder of Facebook. And the reason for that is that I knew at some point this guy was going to do something that I disagreed with so totally and completely that I would not want my name to be connected to that. And I was 100% right about that.
When did you first start to think to yourself that this guy has some character flaws?
Oh, about 5 seconds after meeting him.
Oh, really?
it was pretty evident that there was something off. And like I said, I started saving all those conversations.
Right. Yeah, very early on.
Yeah. But and now people have seen him testify before Congress, so I think you can kind of get a sense that, like, yeah, he has some kind of neurological condition that causes him to not express himself the way that most people do. And to some extent, I have pity for him for having to deal with that, but it also has rendered him a sociopath. And when you're dealing with sociopaths, you really have to be careful because they don't care about your pity, right? They don't care about anyone. They will often have a fixed idea of what the world should be like. And you can see this in Trump. You can see this in Mark. You can see this in a lot of people in Silicon Valley who are prominent.
What about Elon Musk?
Oh, I think it's probably there in Elon Musk. I wasn't sure for a while, but, you know, recent events have suggested that there's that possibility anyway. But yeah, to go back to Cambridge Analytica, they were building this platform, and they decided that, again, growth is priority number one. To get the most people on the platform, you just open up as much as possible all the user data. You know, everything you could want to do with Facebook data, if you're a developer on our platform, you can do it. You know, no strings attached. Just download the whole damn thing if you feel like it. You know, they didn't quite say it quite that way, but that was the message and got across. And people basically did, right? You know, they made it possible for years to obtain information, not just on the particular user that was interacting with your Facebook app, but on their friends, even if the friends didn't consent, which is crazy, right? I mean, it's hard to believe that someone thought this was a good idea, but Mark thought this was a good idea. And I have no doubt that he personally signed off on almost everything having to do with this, although that somehow magically was not the focus of the congressional hearing. But so, you know, that from like 2007 to I think maybe 2012, the Facebook platform was a thing. And in Silicon Valley, I eventually moved there, and I remember people were all talking about it, and they were just like salivating over it. The VCs thought this was the best thing to ever happen. This was happening at the same time the iPhone was launched. So now there's this like social, local, mobile, hellish triumvirate of you know, buzzwords. And so Cambridge Analytica, which is the British, I guess, subsidiary of SEL Group that ended up you know, being the namesake of this scandal, they hired a Cambridge University researcher, Alexander Kogan, who built an app on this platform and was able to use this extremely lenient policy to obtain millions upon millions of profiles of people. And, you know, I'm not entirely sure that anyone was, like, certainly not physically harmed or directly harmed as a result of this, but the harm is more abstract, I think. It's not that, you know, person X had this or that stolen and they found out about it later, because I don't think anyone even would have known, really. I think that the abstract harm, which is certainly real, is that then this information was used in the sort of big data kind of project by, I guess, Cambridge Analytica, the company which had been employed by the, and getting a little bit confused with all the players here, but the Republican Party, I guess, contracted with them or something like that. And then there's a question about how much the the Russians had influence into this because the Russians have a relationship, of course, with many, many companies in Russia, such as Lukoil, which had a connection. So, I mean, the upshot, I guess, is that you don't really know who's using the data once it gets out there. And if the data happens to be used by political consultants with bad faith or by foreign governments, you know, that is something that is deeply concerning. But funnily enough, the settlement that I'm not allowed to discuss in much detail, except for the press release that came out of it, which you can find, I think, still on Facebook's newsroom site. If you go to that site and you look for May 22nd, 2009, I think is the date. That's the date of the press release. And it's, you know, kind of a boring sounding press release. They settle a trademark dispute, big deal.
Yeah, Facebook and Think Computer Corporation resolve trademark dispute. Think Computer Corporation and Facebook announced today that they have settled all outstanding claims, including all of Think's claims related to Facebook's registered trademarks. On January 10th, 2006, the USPTO issued U.S. registration number 3,041,791 to Facebook for the mark Facebook. On July 25th, the USPTO issued a second registration to Facebook. In April 2008, Think filed a petition to cancel the registration ending in 052. In March 2009, Think filed a petition to cancel the 791 registration. In the settlement, Think agrees to abandon its petitions and cancel the registrations. Think's CEO and founder Aaron Greenspan attended Harvard with Facebook CEO and founder Mark Zuckerberg in 2002 to 2004, where both were entrepreneurially minded programmers. Starting in August 2003, Think released a web-based student portal called House System through a Harvard student group. This software was designed to make life easier for students, faculty, and alumni. By September 2003, House System featured a section devised and implemented by Greenspan called the Universal Facebook, sometimes called the Facebook. Think's system contained a number of features, including a course scheduler, student marketplace, email service, automatic birthday reminder, message boards, photo album, digital flyer advertising, event calendar with online RSVPs, map integration, job placement, and local business reviews. At launch, House System did not feature member profiles due to campus security concerns. Profiles were added after Zuckerberg launched Facebook in February 2004, along with new features allowing friends to record the way they had met and noting the strength of their relationship. Mark Zuckerberg commented, "Aaron and I studied together at Harvard, and I've always admired his entrepreneurial spirit and love of building things. I appreciate his hard work and innovation that led to building House System, including the Universal Facebook feature. At school, I was even a member of House System. We are pleased that we've been able to amicably resolve our differences." And Aaron Greenspan commented, "I am glad that my contributions have been recognized by Facebook. Mark has built a tremendous company at Facebook, and I wish them continued success in the future." So Aaron that I'm talking to right now doesn't sound like Aaron in this press release. Aaron at this press release is saying Mark has built a tremendous company and you're wishing them continued success. And Aaron today, 9 years later, is saying Mark Zuckerberg's a sociopath and Facebook is an extremely detrimental piece of software.
Yeah, well, you know, it was a negotiated settlement.
Got you.
That's all I can say. You know, sometimes if you want to walk out the door, you have to agree to certain things. And I agreed to the wording of that press release. And I also agreed that they would have absolutely no limitation whatsoever on my ability to speak. So I'm exercising my right.
That was going to be my next question. With it, right.
I would be happy to talk to them in court if they don't like what I'm saying.
Right. I'm sure you would.
But, yeah, so that's the press release. And that was May 22nd?
May 22nd, 2009.
Okay, so May 22nd was a Friday. They posted that at 11:48 p.m. that Friday.
Okay.
That was the Friday before Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, well, lots of companies do that.
Sure, of course. And my lawyers were not smart enough to consider that possibility. That bothered me at the time, and maybe still does now. but because the upshot was that nobody wrote about the settlement and nobody knew that this had even happened.
Right.
Which for me was problematic because the whole idea was to restore my reputation. A lot of people in the Valley that I talked to trying to raise venture capital, they literally thought I was nuts. And you can't really blame them either, because you got to keep in mind they already had heard about the Winklevosses, so there's already someone else claiming that it was their idea, right?
Right.
Plus Vivian Arendt. Plus, then you've got Paul Seglia, who actually was nuts, who like created a fraudulent contract. He had worked on some like Craigslist related thing with Mark, and you know he had a contract with Mark, but then he doctored it to make it seem like he owned 50% of the company. And so, you know, I seem like the fifth guy down who's claiming that it's their project, and it's, you know, who's going to believe that guy, right? So the fact that this didn't get written about and the New York Times refused to write about it, even though Brad Stone, who was the reporter at the time, had relied on me to get him information about the Winklevosses for his reporting, which I found kind of amazing. You know, it meant that I had a real uphill battle trying to make a living. It was a problem. But what's super interesting is that what happened on May 25th has now come back into the current debate. May 22nd was Friday, 23rd, 24th, 25th was Monday. And on that Monday, $200 million showed up from Russia.
What do you mean?
And we now know, well, they announced a major round of investment from Goldman Sachs.
Facebook did.
And Yuri. Facebook did.
In 2009, you're talking about. So you're talking about 3 days after the press release went out.
The next business day.
Okay.
So I was essentially the last checkbox.
Got it.
I had to check.
Got it.
In order to get this massive amount of funding from Russia. And it was officially from Yuri Milner, who's a well-known investor, Russian, of course. And Goldman Sachs had some role in the deal. But we now know from media reports that actually the source of Milner's money, I believe, was VTB Bank. And the source of that money was very likely the Kremlin. So, I mean, that's all kind of nuts, right? that this company today being examined for its role in enabling Russian meddling, the entire time has had
major investors. Well, when you say they took capital from Russia, so this guy Milner that you're talking about, he's a Russian national? He's a Russian
Russian
citizen? He lives in Russia or he lives in the United States?
Well, he has multiple residences at this point, but I think he is a Russian citizen who came to the United States to invest, is my impression.
Okay. And who worked for a company that has ties to the Kremlin?
No, he didn't. He's an entrepreneur. He started something, I think, called mail.ru.
Okay.
And the issue is that, you know, he has his, I guess, limited partners. And the issue is that VTB Bank gave him this money to invest. And people have serious questions about that source of funding. And why it is that he was given this money in the first place.
Right. So this is in 2009.
This isn't me speaking so much as I'm trying to recall what I've read in the media about that deal. But
okay.
Certainly that next Monday that caught my attention. I didn't know about the VTB aspect at the time, but, anyway, so with Cambridge Analytica, the fear is that this network is hugely valuable as an intelligence asset, right? Whether it's for an election or for some other purpose, the fact that you have essentially all of America's beliefs and thoughts in one place that's accessible electronically and is searchable electronically, I mean, that's a real, it's a national security risk is what it is. And now, doubtless that there are people at Facebook who understand that, even if not Mark. And I'm glad that there are probably some responsible employees of the company who take that seriously. But unfortunately, there weren't enough, and it's kind of too late. And on top of that, you had Mark's response. I think this was in like November of 2016, when he was asked if it was possible that Facebook had some role in this. And he said, oh, that's crazy. But of course, it isn't crazy. It's actually like fact. So, you know, this gets into like how he has run the company and his role as a CEO. And I just think that the market's been incredibly short-sighted trusting this guy with so much, and with not just so much data, but now so much money. Everyone through ETFs and the fact that they're an S&P 500 component, somehow people's money have all gotten into Facebook, and it's just crazy.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was just reading last week, like the FANG stocks make up like 20% of U.S. GDP or something ridiculous. I forget what it was. I read something similar to that. I mean, do you think Zuckerberg is complicit, or do you think he just doesn't know, or do you think he just doesn't care? Because, you know, for me, it's tough to justify that he would let this happen, knowing that the result would be, you know, Donald Trump winning an election, which I don't know his political ideology, but I'm sure that it's not in line with whatever Donald Trump's is. I mean,
you'd be surprised. I mean, I also don't know exactly what his political ideology is. All I can say is, you know, what I think based on what I've seen. And here's what I've seen. The general counsel of Facebook, who I had to deal with when I was negotiating my settlement, was Ted Olyat. Ted Olyat was the chief of staff for former attorney general and one of my least favorite political figures ever, Alberto Gonzalez, during the Bush administration. I don't know if you remember Alberto Gonzalez and his tenure much, but...
Not really, nothing in detail. I was probably busy drinking Natural Light in a basement while that was happening somewhere.
I mean, everyone's entitled to their political beliefs, and in some ways, I guess I would even think of myself as maybe slightly... Well, I think overall I'm quite liberal, but I have some conservative thoughts here and there. I don't know how anyone on either side of the political spectrum can think that someone like Gonzalez was a successful attorney general. And, you know, the fact that Olyat worked for him would, if I were in Mark's shoes, have given me extreme pause to hire someone like that. But that's who the general counsel was. Someone who essentially enabled the NSA to go in and, you know, have free reign with Facebook, which is another whole scandal of its own. Then you've got the whole issue with Mark, funding some very conservative causes. I think they've run ads on, like, immigration issues that, you know, they're interested, of course, in getting visas for their foreign workers. But time and again, the only political activity I've seen from Mark has been on the more conservative side. So for him to want someone like Trump, you know, maybe before he understood fully what Trump would be like, that doesn't surprise me much.
Do you think he's ultimately going to run for president?
Oh, I think his presidential ambitions are long since dashed at this point. And I'm so glad, because I think that would be really terrifying. Like, as if we didn't have a good sense at this point of what life is like with a sociopath billionaire president, the last thing we need is another one of those. I mean, it would be different, and Mark is arguably much smarter, but... I think the only thing worse than a dumb sociopath president is a smart sociopath president.
So I just want to go back to my question before about the Cambridge Analytica thing. I mean, do you think What do you think the thought process was behind allowing them to have access to this data? Do you think they legitimately didn't understand what it was going to be used for? Do you think they were willfully ignorant and just wanted the money? I mean, to me, I'm not as familiar with the situation or the players as you are, but to me, it seems like a situation where the likely thing that happened was probably that these guys were the highest bidder for this data, and you know, they saw it as a way to make money, and they sold it to them.
My understanding is not that anyone was bidding on the data, right? So this wasn't really so much an auction as it was a free for all. The idea was that as a developer, you would sign up, you would agree to terms and conditions about how you were supposed to use the data that no one really took seriously, and then you could do with it what you liked. And so Kogan signed up, he agreed to the terms and conditions, I believe, and then he turned around and sold his app and I guess the data with it to Cambridge Analytica. Now, Facebook can make probably a good faith argument that they didn't know that that was happening.
Right.
Right? How would they? Probably things like that, excuse me, happened many hundreds or thousands of times with different developers. But what they can't say is that this wasn't totally predictable, because when you give the entire world full access to a database of hundreds of millions of profiles, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, you really have to be completely brain dead to not foresee some possible abuse. And, you know, as I've tried to emphasize, Mark's only interest for more than a decade, maybe a decade and a half, has been growth and avoiding at all costs obstacles to that growth. So actually policing the use of this data and actually verifying the identities of the people signing up to use it and actually going out and conducting site visits and audits and being a more professional, responsible company, which is why Sheryl Sandberg is there nominally. That's not in their interests from his perspective. You know, that won't get them more users. That won't get them China, right? Their next big growth opportunity. So yes, in one sense, Facebook has some plausible deniability there. But, you know, they easily could have seen this coming, and they really should have, because it's gross, willful negligence otherwise.
So what do you think the future of Facebook looks like from here? I mean, talk about it as an investment from a valuation standpoint and a cash generation standpoint, and talk about it as where you just think the site is going to go. Because, you know, it's been my experience over the last maybe year or two since I've talked to younger people about Facebook that it seems very super saturated at this point. It seems like everybody that could possibly have an account has one. You know, when there's elderly people with accounts and there's people making accounts for their newborn infants, and it has gone from just, you know, Facebook really to this giant kind of, I mean, there's so I'm looking at my Facebook profile right now, and you have Messenger and you have, you know, Facebook Video and Marketplace and events, groups, pages, jobs, fundraisers, friend lists, memories pages, and then, you know, on the right you got all your Messenger stuff, you got games, you have, you know, sponsored shit, you have, I mean, it just seems like there's so much crap on Facebook. And you know, the news feed used to be you could look at your friends' pictures and look at their what they have to say about it, and that's that. And now it has turned into, you know, tons of advertisements and all these stupid videos and these little like anecdotes that people post. And I think to some degree probably Instagram appealed to people because it was very simple and it was just photos and what people captioned on them.
Right.
And now Instagram's kind of starting.
You're right.
I think Instagram's kind of starting to go the same way. There's so much shit on Facebook. If there's one thing, like, I really like the website Seeking Alpha. I tell George Moriarty, the editor, all the time that one of my favorite things about it is it's a very simple layout. It's easy to use. It's clean looking. The advertisements aren't offensive. There is a good amount of data, but you're not overwhelmed. You can navigate it easily. And I feel like Facebook is starting to become kind of this big bloated, kind of stumbling drunk here a little bit. And again, I'm just looking at my timeline now. And, you know, every third or fourth thing is either an advertisement, a sponsored post, or some type of clickbait headline, or it's people you may know, or it's, you know, businesses that you might be interested in. And it's just not, I feel like it has just deviated from what it was years ago when I first signed up, which was, you know, a place to stalk people online and, you know, check out women and, you know, learn about right. your friends' interests. And I mean, I don't know. It just feels like this big bloated mess at this point. And like I said, I think that's probably why Instagram became popular, because it started over from scratch. It was a photo and a caption, and that was it. And now Instagram kind of starting to go the same way too. So what do you think the future of the site is? I mean, do you think they have opportunities, or does it feel super saturated to you too?
Well, I haven't had an account of my own since 2012, but my family members have accounts, like most family members.
Does that piss you off
these days? It's not ideal, but I understand. I have a severely disabled brother, and both because he wants to make friends and because there's support groups for people with his particular conditions online that are Facebook groups. I mean, I can't really complain about my family wanting to have access to that kind of resource. But
so you see some positive in the site.
Oh, no. I mean, I think those are very limited positives, and they could easily be duplicated or replicated on some other non-Facebook site. And,
right, but my point is that, you know, you think, obviously, look, you just justified the fact that, you know, you said you have a brother who's disabled, and, you know, there's support groups and there's things that help him out. And I guess to some degree, I'm sure it helps him and many others connect with the world. I mean, so would you concede that that's a positive?
Let me finish the thought. So, unfortunately, the efforts he's made, without going into too much detail here, because I want to respect his privacy, but
sure.
The efforts he's made to make friends on Facebook, I think, have been largely unsuccessful, and a large part of the reason for that is that the vast majority of people he interacts with on that site are fake accounts. You know, they're people in the Philippines, Ukraine, Egypt, Bangladesh, wherever, that are trying to get money out of Americans, often elderly or disabled, and they will strike up a conversation, post some attractive looking picture, and then ask for like a Western Union transfer or MoneyGram or an iTunes card or, you know, whatever it is. And unfortunately, my brother doesn't fully understand that there's this like international crime dynamic going on that he's trying to get of, but you know, part of being a victim, not participating, obviously. But so in terms of Facebook's future, I think that is actually its future, right? The problem is it is saturated. Anyone who wanted to sign up for Facebook is pretty much already signed up, I think, at this point. You know, maybe they'll get a few new kids who are coming up through school to sign up. But as you said, Instagram seems to be more popular with like the younger generation, and especially now Snapchat and whatever's next. So,
well, I feel like the younger generation isn't even signing up for it. I mean, when I talk to the kid bagging my groceries at ShopRite, and he tells me he doesn't even have a Facebook account, everybody uses Snapchat and Instagram. That tells me everything I need to know. And also, when I look on Facebook, all I see is them trying to copy now what everybody else is doing. So they have stories Snapchat had that Instagram also kind of copied, and then they have video. They're trying to kind of make their own YouTube feature as well, you can tell. So they're
right.
they're doing what it looks like you.
They don't think for themselves. They copy everyone else, and they do a half-assed job on it. But they're big, so they use their scale to make up for it. You know, it's totally the Microsoft model, 100%. But the thing is, they own Instagram. So the fact that kids are using Instagram means that they will derive some benefit of that until, as you said, they ruin it. And, you know, that's inevitable. And you know, it's not just them. Like, you can see this, you know, Microsoft essentially became the next IBM, this big, stodgy, you know, behemoth that no one really likes all that much, but they kind of have to use because it's there.
Right.
So...
And that's how Microsoft got huge. It wasn't, you know, they offered a you know, when Microsoft was kind of jockeying for position with Apple in the late 80s and early 90s, and, you know, Apple was transitioning from the Apple to the Macintosh, and, you know, Windows was just being developed. I mean, they just beat Apple to the punch. They had a shittier operating system that was far less innovative to use, and the user experience was much worse, but they got it to market first, and that was it. I mean, that's how they won, right?
Well, I don't know if they got it to market first or if they just had a much better distribution deal with IBM that allowed them to put the OS on the clones like Compaq and whoever else was around back then. But I think the company definitely has major challenges challenges ahead, because you can't do what Mark has done and optimize only for quantity and have no quality,
right?
And expect that that's going to hold up in the long run,
right?
You know,
right.
That is, there's got to be a trade-off somewhere, right? And so if, first of all, you've got everyone's mom and dad and grandmother and grandfather on the network, then by definition, it is no longer cool. So you've already lost the initial impetus for people to sign up. Like, no one at Harvard would have signed up for either of our sites if their mothers had been on it as well.
Right. So, and I remember when that first started happening too, because Facebook came out.
That's been the case for a long time.
It became prominent like when I was in college, and it was a great way to kind of, you know, get to know your peers. But I remember when family members first started popping up, I was like, well, this is fucking weird. Like, you know, what's my aunt doing on Facebook? What's my uncle doing on Facebook? You know, like, what is this, right? There was a little bit of that feeling, I remember.
And it's a perfect example of how Mark has always had this fascination, I think, with defying social norms. Like, you saw it with FaceMash. You saw it with the privacy battle around my Facebook and the way that his kind of flipped that on its head, and suddenly it was okay to share everything. And so you're seeing it again with, like, you know, now your whole family can be part of your friend group, which is not how social dynamics work, actually. But so there's that problem, the whole awkwardness issue. But then on top of that, then you add in the fake account problem, which they are, I would like to make a specific point of this. In their quarter four 2017 slide deck, and granted there are other materials in the 10Q and whatever, but I think the slide deck is where they talk about this specifically. The last page is their disclaimer page, and they say something like, you know, in quarter four 2017, we had 3-4% fake accounts, which actually, if you do the math, is like, what, 60-80 million or something. But, you know, we work hard on this, and we have various algorithms, and we monitor the accounts, and we will update it regularly, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so then you go to quarter one 2018. Same exact verbiage about the same exact quarter four 2017 they're talking about. So it's the prior quarter, maybe not such a big deal. But now it's quarter two 2018. They put out their slide deck again. It's still the exact same verbiage. They haven't updated anything about their fake accounts. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think the number of fake accounts on the site is vastly higher than what they are disclosing to the public. And I don't mean like
1-2%. What do you base that on?
I base it on seeing my brother's interactions. I base it on the stuff that I read in the media, and I base it on having built the very, very, very early database for this thing and knowing how difficult it is to actually know, right, if something is fake or not. Like, there have been articles about...
You're just basing it on the fact that the company, you don't think the company has a good enough grasp on who is fake and who isn't. They don't have the verification quality control in there. Is that what you're saying?
They can't. They just cannot. The people with an incentive to create these accounts and sell them, which happens all the time, and you can go online and search and buy a bunch of accounts for yourself if you want, or thousands. They will always be able to be one step ahead of the company. And then you keep in mind that this is a company that A, acts in bad faith all the time, and B, has no financial incentive to police this, because they want to show that they have more monthly active users and more daily active users every quarter.
And when you say something like they act in bad faith all the time, I mean, that's a pretty serious allegation.
But it's easily substantiated. Sure, it's serious. But look at the number. I mean, I can't even keep track of the number of scandals that Facebook has had to trot Mark out for to apologize. There was Beacon in 2007. They had to restate their video metrics recently. I think it was like the 10th time they've restated their various metrics. You know, they've got Cambridge Analytica. They've got the fact that Mark is now saying that Holocaust deniers, he's got a German Jewish name, for God's sakes, Holocaust deniers don't have intent, which then their PR team had to walk.
That's not the, I don't think that's the company acting in bad faith. And you know, I just don't know. I mean, we know about Cambridge Analytica was a huge deal. And I think there's probably a discussion about negligence that needs to happen there, definitely. The other scandals that you mentioned, Beacon in 2007, I'm not familiar with. Restating their video metrics. Also, I'm not...
But hold on. I think this isn't even really a debatable point. I mean, the company is founded on the idea of bait and switch, which to me is bad faith. Right?
How is the company founded on bait and switch?
Because early on, you were signing up for a closed network. I mean, and then granted, this changed over time, but that's kind of my point. They told their users, you know, you're signing up for a Harvard site. Then they told their users, you're signing up for a collegiate site. Then they told their users, you're signing up for a site that is colleges and high schools. Then they told their users, you're signing up for a site that's colleges, high schools, and also your family members. And, you know, there have been various policy changes along the way to accommodate these gradual increases in the user base, so that at any given point when you signed up for Facebook, what you signed up for is not what the site is today. It's a completely different product. As you were saying, it's full of ads. It's full of garbage. It's, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, you might call that bait and switch. I call that, you know, a company that's evolving and changing.
Well, you can call it what you want, but I don't think that they have built a product that they are providing to their users with a good faith expectation of that product providing the same service over time that people expected, at the very base level, regardless of any of their other scandals. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just too traditionalist and expect that when I pay for a product, I'm going to get that thing, and, you know, it's not going to morph on me over time.
Well, you're not paying for it.
Well, you aren't paying directly, but of course, you're paying for it with your information, essentially.
I mean, the user has a choice, right? The user has a choice to log on to Facebook every day or not log on to Facebook every day. Or to have an account or not have an account.
And part of the problem here is that there isn't enough other choice because, you know, it's actually really hard. I've seen people saying, oh, well, you know, someone should just build an alternative platform and charge a monthly fee and let people use that instead. But it's actually surprisingly difficult today to build one of these platforms because the expectations that users have are so elevated relative to when I coded up the first thing in 2003. You know, I could build a website back then that worked on, like you said, Netscape and IE, and generally that was enough. Now you have to build this thing that has integrated chat, and it has a Android app and an iPhone app, and it's got to perform at a pretty good level on a lot of different platforms, and you know, people expect that. So
you know, when Facebook separated Messenger from Facebook and you had to download the separate app to use Messenger, I remember thinking that was ridiculous. And but then I downloaded it anyways because I wanted to message with people on Facebook. And so I think that's kind of a microcosm of what I'm trying to argue, which is I wanted the functionality. You know, I made the choice. I knew why they were doing it, right? It's more app downloads, probably more avenues for advertisement to kind of start to spin this off as a second product. You know, but I did it because I wanted to have the accessibility to the features. And there, you know, there's certain people that I have contact with on Facebook that I don't have their phone numbers or I don't have their emails. So I wanted to use that as a medium for communication. But I'm having trouble differentiating between a company that's mired in scandal that does everything from a position of bad faith, and a company that's trying to grow and a company that's trying to make more money.
Well, I mean, I don't know what to say. If you think Facebook is a company that operates in good faith, then...
Well, look, to be honest with you, you know, I'm a skeptic, right, by nature. So, you know, I try to call out bullshit when I see it, but I also understand that on the capitalism playing field, boundaries get pushed often. And certainly I want corporations and I want individuals to respect the rule of law. Like you said, I want them to operate lawfully and I want them to do what they can do within the permitted boundaries of the laws and the regulations in their specific sector to try to grow and to try to earn more money. Like with Herbalife, for example, you know, my argument on Herbalife wasn't only that they were truly fostering a culture of deception, but that inherently the company wasn't lawful because at its, you know, core, mathematically, it's a pyramid scheme. Facebook, when I look at it, the Cambridge Analytica thing, I think, needs to be examined very closely. And I think that made an impact on a lot of people. I think
here's what I would say to that.
Well, hold on. Let me just finish the thought. Let me finish the thought real quick. I think that really put a lot of it put their intent and it put the question of negligence and liability into the public standpoint. Or into the public viewpoint, rather. And I think the company is going to be looked at different going forward. But I think if you want to make an argument against the company right now, I think the argument that the company is super saturated and is about to go the way of MySpace, in my opinion, is a far more cogent argument than coming out and lobbing kind of accusations of doing everything in bad faith when I don't know. I'm having trouble reconciling that in my head. I mean, maybe it's different for you because you knew Mark Zuckerberg personally, but I don't know. To me, I'm not seeing evidence that everything they do is in bad faith and that they are.
Well, I think I would recommend going back and looking at some of these articles that have been written, which are compendiums of the company's various scandals over time, because I think the Washington Post and probably other publications have timelines of every single time Marcus had to go out and apologize for the company misleading its consumers deliberately. And you know, I don't think most of these are just kind of oops situations. These are choices that they deliberately made.
Right.
That's one point. The other point is that you're totally right that there are some companies that are so horrendous, like Herbalife, like Credit Acceptance, that they are clearly beyond the bounds of the law. and they should be basically shut down accordingly. I'm not arguing that Facebook is an unlawful criminal organization. You know, the way that at some points in its history, it seems that Herbalife has been. What I'm arguing is actually a step below that, which is bad faith. And in fact, I think Mark himself summarized this better than I can, which is a quote that I'm not sure if I'm going to get it exactly right unless I can find it really fast. But this is something that he told to, I think, his friend Adam D'Angelo, who now runs Quora, on an AIM conversation. He said, "You can be unethical and still be legal. That's the way I live my life. Ha ha." I mean, that quote, which for some reason he put in writing, summarizes, I think, completely what it means to have bad faith. It, you know, you can still be abiding by the letter of the law, or right, even maybe, you know, many laws. But if you are violating the spirit of the law, that's bad faith. And that is the way that Mark has lived his life. I think he's proven that out. Mark is the company, right? I've never seen a company with such a high rating for its CEO. People adore him who work there for some reason. They think that essentially his word is gospel. And the way that he views the world has had, which I think is a seriously distorted view, has had a huge impact. And so I stand by the bad faith argument. I don't think that's even that serious of a it's a serious charge, but it's not like that controversial of a statement.
Right, it's not like saying they're willingly breaking the law.
Yeah, the company has time and again deceived its users. Mark personally has time and again lied in public on video about the company's founding, at the very least, which is what I know about, you know, firsthand. You know, there's another video of him at like Y Combinator startup school where he says he made the whole thing in 2 weeks, which is clearly not true. I mean, so I don't know. I guess my point is that I agree with you. The whole, you know, MySpace AOL dynamic is like the red light should be flashing at Facebook headquarters. Like, this could all go up in smoke if they don't make some more acquisitions to get, you know, get the next.
Yeah, well, that was my next question. Do you think because of their size that they're going to be able to withstand it? I mean, do you think they'll mutate as a company and just wind up going in another direction?
It's possible. They certainly have enough money right now, unless we see, you know, additional massive stock drops and they have to suddenly scramble or something. But, you know, they're basically like Coca-Cola. They're gonna survive by buying new brands and, you know, testing things here and there. Excuse me. And they could easily persist for another decade or two with that strategy. It worked for Microsoft. It's working for Coke. You know, they can be a comfortable large company that no one really remembers the heyday of. Just like, you know, how many people now remember Windows 95? Does that make it a good investment? You know, I have no idea. I'm not very good at predicting investment things, unfortunately. But I think it makes it a lot less interesting of a company to work at if you're a programmer coming out of a top CS program. Do you want to go work for the stodgy has-been, or do you want to go work for the new, cool, you know, whatever network or
right, and to some degree, you know, they have to abide by the law of large numbers now that they're a $500 billion market cap company. I mean, that's about as big as you can get right now. And you know, their trajectory for growth is gonna have to, you know, they're gonna have to basically go the Amazon route, which is going into everything. And I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I see Amazon as a company that's going to try and dominate every single industry and be ultimately, yeah, you know, the world's kind of one-stop corporation years from now. And I think they're going to have to, I don't know, they're going to have to start thinking like that in order to push, you know, past the trillion market cap mark And because I don't think that just being a social media company and just relying on your users and advertising is going to hold up for them. And I think we're starting to see a little bit of that.
Yeah. Certainly, the populace is far more educated now about social networking and social media than it was in 2004, right? People had seen MySpace, but I don't think they really understood the model. And this has really only happened in the past year, which is unfortunate. I think it should have happened a long time ago. But now people kind of get that they're being played when they sign up for a social network to some extent, that, you know, this isn't really free, that there are consequences. And I guess my question is less, what is their stock price going to be? Although, of course, I'd like it to go lower. And I should disclose that recently I bought Facebook puts so that, you know, I'm not totally unbiased financially, but I was never unbiased to start with in this particular domain. The question I have is, should we be giving a company that so far almost brought fascism to the United States or played a part in that a free pass? Like, do you get to keep going on?
I can't connect those dots, though. I can't connect those dots. I can't draw a straight line from the Cambridge Analytica scandal to a company single-handedly bringing fascism to the United States. I mean, don't you think you're goofing the floof a little bit there?
No, I don't. I think, look, there are people who believe in some form of objective truth and fact, and there are people who don't. And Mark is one of these people who doesn't. The fact that you've got someone in that kind of powerful position who really, he doesn't see the difference between, you know, truth and falsity, and just everything's a shade of gray. And that's why you get things like this debate over whether they should kick off InfoWars, right? Anyone who believes in there being objective truth would not tolerate for a second InfoWars on their platform. And yet, this is a real big question for Facebook. Somehow they don't quite see how that might be a problem.
But I think that becomes a question of whether or not they want to moderate the content on their site. Like, I don't agree with almost everything that InfoWars says, but I would agree with the concept of having a social media site where, you know, people are allowed to voice their opinions and give their perspective on things regardless. I mean, a lot of these social media sites are doing this, but, and I just, you know, one of the podcasts I just did a couple days ago, the guy was telling me that, you know, his friend had like a libertarian podcast and they booted him or they took some of his subscribers or whatever. And I don't know that as a content creator myself now, that's frightening because there's a, you can draw kind of a straight line and there is a slippery slope from, well, booting Alex Jones because he said some things that were abhorrent to kicking people off because you don't agree with what they say politically. I think there's a case to be made for having a site where people are allowed to say what they want to say. I mean, don't you? And don't you think it's a huge drain on resources to get that in depth into, you know, managing the content?
I guess no. I think that when you cross some lines, you know, free speech is not totally absolute. I think there should be a very wide berth, certainly with political speech. But I don't think that what InfoWars is doing is political speech in a lot of respects.
So what were they kicked off for InfoWars?
Well, you mean from YouTube?
Were they booted from Facebook? Is that what you're talking about?
Oh, they were given a temporary suspension, but I don't think they were actually booted per se. I mean, that's why I'm saying, like,
Here it is. Facebook suspends U.S. conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. Alex Jones, the American...
It's a 30-day suspension.
Alex Jones, the American conspiracy theorist who runs the InfoWars website, has been suspended from Facebook for bullying and hate speech. The suspension will last for 30 days and affects only Jones's personal account, not the InfoWars account. Okay. His profile will continue to be published, but he will not be able to post content. Okay. Our community standards make it clear that we prohibit content that encourages physical harm or attacks someone based on their religious affiliation or gender identity. Okay, I'm all right with that. We remove content that violates our standards as soon as we're aware of it. In this case, we receive reports related to 4 different videos on the pages that InfoWars and Alex Jones maintain on Facebook. We reviewed the content against our standards and determined that it violates it. And now, hold on 1 second. I'm just trying to figure out what exactly he said. I can't find it, but I'm not against this. I think that they're being rational with the way that they're handling this.
I guess my point is, you know, you're asking how do you draw the line between Facebook and fascism, right? And the way I draw the line is you start with somebody at the top of Facebook who does not really have respect for truth or fact. And then you give that person a huge bullhorn and you have that person give a free pass to essentially intelligence agencies the world over, if they feel like it, to come in and use the site for many years. And, you know, at that point, it's out of their hands and anything can happen. So I actually don't think it's really that much of a stretch. And I think there's...
So you think Mark Zuckerberg is a threat to national security?
Oh, absolutely.
And you think...
No question.
You think Facebook is a serious threat to national security?
Yes, and I think there are many on the Senate Intelligence Committee who would agree.
Interesting. Oh, that's really interesting.
And I'm not saying that's all it is, right?
Yeah, no, but I mean, I just find it interesting because I'm not super well versed in this whole situation coming into it, which is one of the reasons I didn't really want to prepare. I kind of wanted to learn as I continued to speak with you, because I'm assuming that the listener doesn't really get it either, and I've just never thought of it that way. So to hear your argument, which I think is cogent in some points, and there's some points I would disagree with, but certainly it's giving me a different perspective on things, the likes of which I haven't had before. And you certainly are a lot closer to it, and you've obviously been a lot closer to the players involved, that there are things that I would just, you know, I would defer to your judgment on.
Yeah, and look, I'll be the first to admit that I haven't talked to Mark recently, so it's not as though I'm coming at this as his best friend or something who knows every thought he has.
I kind of figured that.
Yeah, right. But I do think that you know, a lot of the points I'm making today are points, well, before Trump, obviously a lot of this hadn't happened yet, but the general tenor of my argument has remained essentially the same since 2004, back to when I was telling my friends in college who never met Mark because, you know, I was doing my entrepreneurship thing and they were doing their whatever they were doing. You know, I would tell them, you know, I met this guy and I really don't trust him and he's done some things that I really don't agree with. And now there's this Facebook thing and then they all sign up for Facebook. And then, you know, this has been going on a long time. And I've always had this extremely critical view of Mark and of Facebook as he's built it. And, you know, the pushback I've gotten on that viewpoint for many years has been pretty strong. You know, I've been called a lot of names. I've been doubted for a long time. And so I'm pretty used to that. But I think recent events have more or less borne out my major concerns. And I think
right.
That's terrible. And I'm very sad that that's the case. But certainly I am not going to temper my remarks now. I think it's
very easy.
Try to scream louder.
I think it's very easy even now for people to come out and listen to what you're saying and just say, look, here's somebody that got snubbed by Zuckerberg or missed the boat and is pissed off or is jealous or anything like that. I think that's probably
there will always be people who think that.
Right. I think that's probably fine. The easiest argument to make. But to your credit, you know, and again, I didn't know you 10 years ago. I didn't know you 5 years ago. I don't really even know you too well right now. But to your credit, certainly now in the public discourse, some of these things that are playing out are – alarming, and I think they're starting to shed some light on some things that you're concerned about. And if the true nature of the problem runs as deep as you're indicating that it does, the public may be learning more in the future, and you know, you may be able to point back to this interview and say, you know, I told you so. Which, you know, I guess it all depends on how things play out.
Yeah, and you know, it could be that Facebook stages a miraculous recovery and things just keep on going up the way they have been for the past decade, and you know, that's possible. I wouldn't rule it out. But what I actually hope happens is that the company has to face some of the music and trying to mix metaphors there, music of its own making perhaps, and you know, suffer some consequences for this kind of behavior. Because like you're saying, even though it's not maybe always technically illegal, there sure seems to be something wrong here.
Right.
And it'll be the job of the FTC and the SEC now, I'm sure, and whatever other government agencies to figure out exactly which bucket to put the wrongdoing into, whether that's statutory or otherwise. But, you know, like something's got to change, because the country can't go on suffering this level of setback at the frequency we've been seeing it recently, whether that's in terms of, you know, political consequences or sudden vaporization of $120 billion every Tuesday or whatever. You know, that should not happen.
Say that last point again.
Well, you know, I'm just saying that the consequences recently have been both political and economic in terms of the stock crashing,
right,
the 120 market cap disappearing. Like, that's not a normal kind of occurrence. And
well, companies, high-flying tech companies do kind of crash and have a tendency to drop, you know, significant amounts. I know,
oh, yeah.
I know from an absolute dollar amount, it was, I think, the largest move in any stock ever. But having said that, I mean, we're the assholes that bid the stock up to where it is anyways right now. So we're reaping what we sow to some degree also, right?
Yes, I agree. But again, why is that? It's because I think the public has been largely misled by
right.
the company.
And I think you make a really good point with the fact that this is tucked. Because, look, one of the things that I hate about the financial markets is they do tuck all of these kind of pile of shit companies into ETFs, into mutual funds. People are inadvertently investing in things that they don't understand, that haven't been properly vetted, that they don't know they're investing in. So one way or another, if you have a 401k or you have you know, some other type of retirement account, or you're holding index funds, or you're holding pretty much probably any technology ETF, you have exposure to this company. And I think a more valid point and a greater concern would be, and I think a lot of people are probably just finding this out after the stock shit the bed this week, but I think an even bigger concern is, you know, if this company is a threat to national security the way that you're claiming it is, I think it's important that people need to understand what they have exposure to and how they have exposure to it. I mean, I was just talking about this with Tesla the other day. I don't like the fact that people inadvertently have exposure to companies like that without them really understanding, you know, the financials, what the company is like, you know, the basics of equity valuation, you know. And you could say, look, that's the appeal of index funds. You could say you're going to get some good with some bad, but I don't know. I mean, I think that's a much, much more alarming point, right? Is here's this company that you're arguing is a threat to national security, and people's pensions and 401ks have exposure to it.
Yeah, no, it's very scary for that reason and others. But I think that also, it's not just Facebook that argument applies to. Like, we really don't know very much about most of the companies we invest in as a country, I think, despite
I would agree with
all
that.
Of the exposures. I think that that's a much bigger, more abstract problem, and it's a real problem. But, you know, so there's the fact that it's a threat to national security, but there's also the fact that I think that just plain old investors are being lied to, and I think that's a problem as well. You know, the fact that they're not being upfront about the fake accounts is a huge deal to me, and I don't think the press is focused on it enough. You know, if the actual number of fake accounts is greater than 3 or 4%, which I am almost positive that it is, then a lot of the company's revenues are based on those accounts, and they are similarly fake.
Right,
and,
they're at risk.
They may be actually getting dollars in the bank from those transactions for advertising, but they may also have liability to potentially refund those dollars
right.
if it's later found out that those were not true clicks, for example.
Sure, sure, yeah. Well, I'd love to have you back on at some point. We'll watch the story play out here over the next couple of quarters, and certainly I'm interested to see if some of the points of concern that you've raised come to fruition. But I would love to have you back, you know, if something else breaks in the news, and we can compare it kind of to what you said here today, and probably get some future analysis from you. I have one last question I wrote down here midway through the interview that I wanted to ask you before we split.
Sure.
Say something nice about Mark Zuckerberg and about Facebook.
Oh, let's see. Trying to think. I mean, I do think that one actual real piece of value, as I said earlier, was the fact that they do have some of these groups for people who suffer from, you know, rare medical conditions. That's something that I can get behind. You know,
sure.
I think that there's a real meaningful contribution there. But I think, unfortunately, that is a tiny percentage of the site's overall activity.
Sure,
and
sure.
As I said, it's something that can be, you know, replicated on a different platform that doesn't have many of the other problems.
Say,
but, you know, so
say
like,
something nice about Mark Zuckerberg.
You know, I really can't. I think there are some people in the world who, you know, maybe he has, like I said, some within his control or something, but there's the angle of what he's done to me on a personal level, which is, you know, why everyone will say I'm jealous or biased or whatever,
right?
But there's the broader angle of what he's done to the world, and I think I can't do that. I really take issue with Mark running the company the way he has, ignoring the warnings that I gave him. I don't think that he should be let off the hook for that. And so I don't want to sugarcoat it with some, you know, trivial, nice thing. I just can't do that.
All right, man. All right. Well, listen, I really appreciate you taking a couple hours this morning. I know it's early for both of us. We both got stuff to do today. It was a really fascinating conversation, man. I learned a lot, and I'm really excited to talk to you in the future about this. Hopefully, as things develop, you know, we can have you back on, and I do want to have you back on to talk about the report that Plainsight did on Herbalife, because I found that fascinating also.
Sure.
And I just thought that was an incredible piece of research that, unfortunately, not enough people have gotten their eyes on. But I would
They can always. I think you interviewed Christine about that as well. So if anyone wants to learn more about that, there's Christine Quoth the Raven cast.
But yeah, all right.
Thank you. Any
closing thoughts? Anything you want to promo or get out there before we, you know, in the last 30 seconds here?
No, I think we're good. And if anyone's listened this long, my thanks and, you know, round of applause. It's been a marathon podcast.
All right, Aaron, thank you. Thank you so much, brother. We'll be in touch soon. All right, man. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Okay. That was Aaron Greenspan, the founder of the original Facebook. And certainly a riveting conversation with him. Learned a lot of shit I didn't know about. And kind of puts a new perspective on the... Oh, God damn it. I just banged my knee. Jesus. I guess from sitting in one spot 2 hours at 7 in the morning, just not being with it. I just mainlined 24 ounces of coffee during that interview, but apparently that's not enough. It certainly puts a different perspective on things and how I'm going to watch the story going forward. So hopefully we can have Aaron back on the podcast. And I have a couple of other people that I'm talking to about coming on next week, so I should have some interesting guests lined up for the podcast. If you've made it this far, I want to sincerely thank you very much for listening. Again, I want to thank my Patreons for continuing to support the podcast. It fucking means everything to me. I really appreciate it. And I will be back within a couple of days. So for now, I am out. Peace.